Welcome to the Ages of Rock podcast with your hosts, Bill Algy, Dennis Talbot, and Alan Tate. We are three guys who have one thing in common, a love of rock and roll. Our goal is to talk about all things rock. We hope you find this show intriguing, funny, and occasionally highly opinionated. Enjoy.
Hey, Ages of Rock podcast fans. This is Bill and Dennis. Woo. We have a guest with us tonight, Steve Girardi. And we'll let Steve introduce himself in just a second, but Alan's not with us tonight. He's feeling more than a little under the weather.
he can't talk, but he doesn't really talk a lot anyway. So
he's got a little bit of a problem there, but we're going to carry on without him because we have got a great guest tonight. And this is going to be a lot of fun. I've done some research. I've got like notes and all kinds of stuff. So that's kind of crazy. I know we don't ever do that. Steve, how are you doing, man?
I'm fantastic. I can't help it.
That's a good way to be. Nothing better than that. So I kind of got connected with Steve. I was reading, I saw an article on Facebook that was it was an interview. That I think Channel 14 or something had done in Evansville. The mayor had announced that somebody was interested in doing something with Mesker Park. Which for those of you in the Evansville area, that's Mesker Park Amphitheater that Dennis and I grew up going to shows there for many years. It's set dormant for, I don't know how many years now, probably 30 years. I don't know, something like that. It's been a long time. Steve was on there talking about his first job in the promotion industry that happened in Evansville, Indiana. So I reached out to Steve and said, you got stories and we want to hear them.
I don't know if they're that good or not, but they all happen. In a nutshell, guys, on May 13th of 1974, I attended a rock concert in my hometown, Columbus, Ohio. It was Edgar Winter touring a new album called They Only Come Out at Night. With that album had the song Frankenstein on it, but actually the song I like was Free Ride, and there were several other songs. And the opening act was the James Gang with a brand new guitar player, the late Tommy Bolin.
Oh, wow.
Who played, I think, on one album with them, then went solo and sadly died. But I remember on that night, with my friend John Kramer at St. John's Arena, saying, look at this. Look at these people running around in these OSU pep board t-shirts. They seem to be in charge. This is what I want to do. And I was 15 at that time. I had tried to play in bands. And quite frankly, I sucked at playing. I mean, I wasn't bad. I was really... This concept of playing bass guitar in time just did not set with me, but I could book our bands. But I had decided on that night on May 13th of 1974, this is what I want to do. And so I started promoting small shows with local bands where I was still in high school. I was 15 at the time. You print up flyers and you rent the VFW lodge in a certain area on a Saturday night. And on that Friday night, you go out to the various high schools when they're playing home football games and flyer the heck out of the guitars, out of the cars. I mean, yeah, that's marketing 101. That's grassroots marketing right there. And you charge $2 a head. And except I didn't learn. Then I thought, well, we split it with the band. Screw that. I should have taken a piece off the top. But that's where I got bit. And then one thing led to another. I started working with bigger bands in town in Columbus. And one of my bands opened for the Babies at the Agora nightclub in Columbus, which is now called the Newport. But Have you ever been to Indianapolis?
Yeah, I'm just south of there. Yep.
Have you ever been to the Vogue?
Yes. Yep.
Yes.
The Agora is twice the size of the Vogue.
Oh.
You can take the Vogue and put it inside the Agora. I cut my teeth in that place. And I met a guy that had just started working for Sunshine Promotions. And I was like, you know, gee, I really want to do this. I had known the guy because he was trying to work with one of the bands I work with. And he said, you can become my, why don't you run for me at a concert? And running is running errands. And I thought, great. And I want to say my first show, I was paid $50. And I thought, God, wow, I'm rich. Golly gee, you know. But that's where you learned your chops in the early 80s, late 70s. And I started running for shows in Columbus and Dayton, a little bit in Cincinnati. I got a reputation with Sunshine Promotions and Belkin Productions, based out of Cleveland, Jam Productions out of Chicago. And that way, you know, one thing led to another. And I really liked Sunshine Promotions because the owners just seemed to like me, and they would ask me, you know, I would get a call out of the blue from Dave Lucas, the owner, or Steve Sebesma. What do you think about this? What do you think about that? I'm like, God, I felt like part of the team. And I made it clear to those guys, I want to work for you at some point. And so long story short, I had moved to San Francisco to live with a girlfriend, but still stayed in touch. And finally, they called me right at about this time of the year in 1984 and said, we're ready to hire you. So I, you know, told her, but she's a motivational speaker. Her brother is a famous guitar player. His name is Robert Fripp. His band is okay. She's British, but no, they're awesome. And she's a motivational speaker that wrote a book, Get What You Want. So instead of like, oh no, you know, and she was older than I, she kind of shoved me in the back, like, go, go, go. This is your dream. Follow it. And so I did. And I got to Indianapolis and they told me, okay, we're double booked on this weekend. You're going to fly down to Evansville on Saturday for a show with a band called Motley Crue, brand new band on the circuit. They had been touring with Ozzy Osbourne. And I knew they were kind of a harder rock, but I didn't know their music. And the opening act was a band called Saxon.
Oh, yeah.
And it's to take place at, I call it Mester Music Theater, and I still will call it that. But lo and behold, it was raining that day. And fortunately, they were able to hold Robert Stadium as a backup venue. Now, Robert Stadium was, in all fairness, was an arena. But I guess when they built it in the 50s, they had to call it a stadium. Yeah. They couldn't call it an arena. And that's how it got its name. And so we moved the show over there. Well, let me back up a little bit. So I get down to Evansville on a Saturday in May 12th. Flew on Brit Airlines, which flew these flying pencils.
You know, I flew Brit one time.
If they had a ride like that at Kings Island, it would be the most treacherous ride in the world.
They'd already closed it and condemned it.
you know, it's bad when you're on a small plane and you overhear somebody who's sitting right here make a comment. You know, last week I was on one of these and they had to do a flyby by the tower to see if the landing gear was down. Like, whoa, boy, do I feel good without this. So,
yeah, they were terrible.
I don't remember if the plane landed or stopped.
It got there. How's that? You got to Evansville.
Get on Fred's cab, go to the Bob Green's Executive Inn in downtown Evansville.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And like, wow, this is so cool. I'm in the business. And I go in the restaurant and suddenly I see some guys that look like they're in a band and they're wearing Motley Crue stuff. I realized that's the band. And I walked up and introduced myself to them and Rich Fisher's the tour manager, Fred Saunders, security guy, you know, the member, the four guys in the band. There was one other person, and I'm hanging out with these guys suddenly. And it started a great, it started a friendship that I haven't seen any of these folks in years. Sadly, one of them's not with us any longer, but it was just kind of fun hanging out with them that night. And the next morning we had to move the show to Roberts. And that was my foray into the industry.
Wow. I don't think everybody gets to start with Motley Crue. That's kind of cool.
You know, but keep in mind, Motley Crue at that time was just really coming up. And every band comes up.
Mm-hmm.
And often, all too often today, there are so many one-hit wonders. And yet they really paid their dues. And I believe they made a great impact on, was it the US Festival or something like that?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yep.
A year earlier.
Huge.
And Motley Crue had a great management team and Doc McGee and Doug Thaler. Doc had been involved with Diana Ross at one point and Kiss at one point, and he still is involved with Kiss.
Mm-hmm.
But they had another baby band called Bon Jovi.
Yeah.
Who was the opening act for Rat for a couple of tours. And that's another story. But, you know, that said, Motley paid their dues and came up well.
Right.
And I really liked those guys. We were all about the same age, and it was just, you know, I didn't listen to the music, but I could relate to them, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. So where was Sunshine? Was it based out in Indianapolis?
Because
I remember as a kid, or when I'm not a kid, but I mean, back in the day, everything that was in the paper, you went, of course, when they put stuff in the paper, we don't have papers hardly anymore either, but you know, it's always Sunshine Promotions, you know,
in the Evansville area.
Yeah.
So we worked with Larry Aiken.
Right. Yeah. And Larry Aiken. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
I loved Larry. I fought like hell with him at times. Larry was more of a Broadway promoter, and we were rock and roll people.
Right.
But Larry knew how to market. And Larry, you know, one of the keys that to promoting sometimes is having somebody with feet on the ground in the market you're promoting in.
Right.
Larry knew how to get good building deals. He knew how to market. You know, it was Larry Aiken that actually started right after I moved to Indy. My second night here, I had to go judge a beauty contest at the Vogue nightclub.
Oh, poor you.
with these two disc jockeys from Q95 named Tom and Bob.
I still listen to Bob and Tom. Well,
you listen to Bob
anymore, but Tom.
I said Tom and Bob intentionally.
Yeah. Yeah.
Having said that, it started Tom Griswold is my longest tenured friend from India since I moved to Indianapolis. We texted the other day for his birthday.
Wow.
But having said that, Larry was one of the first people to get them to syndicate.
Mm,
really?
Wow.
And they syndicated down to WGBF in Evansville.
Right.
And several others around. And at one point, they were up to, I think, 150, 160 stations.
Right. Yeah. I don't know where they're at now. Yeah. Quite a few.
Because his company was Aiken Management, right?
Aiken Management.
Yeah.
And he was more on the Broadway side of things.
Gotcha.
But, and he didn't really, I don't think Larry liked the rock and roll promoting, but I think he liked the money that he made.
Yeah, I can understand that. That makes sense. That makes perfect sense. Yeah, for sure.
That's awesome.
So was your role then, to kind of to just go and do different shows in the beginning? Is that kind of how it was before you kind of had your own?
I was a production manager, which meant you put everything together.
Okay.
And it was, there's no real guide on how to do this. And you really have to learn on the go, and you have to pretend that you know what you're doing. I thought I was doing good, doing a few shows. And then on June 30th of 1984, I did a Grateful Dead show. And if you remember the Shawshank Redemption, mm-hmm. when Red said that was the longest night of my life. At that time, that was the longest night of my life.
So it wasn't an easy situation to endure.
Not with the condition they were in. I later did many shows with them, and it worked out well. But just, you know, I always say it's okay to scrape your knees, just don't scrape them in the same place twice.
That's interesting.
But it was still just learning it. And I always wanted to get into talent buying, which I eventually did.
So how long were you with Sunshine then? Or with
20 years.
Yeah, 20 years.
Wow. Sunshine formed 72, 73, give or take. And they eventually sold in 97 to a company called SFX. Mm. Now, let me explain SFX. Robert Sillerman was a brilliant man. He's deceased now. That could really, he knew how to get money. He knew how to sell. He knew how to take a company public and how to sell it at the right time. And at the end of the day, life is all, it can be about money. But Sillerman got with a guy named Lowry Mays, who had a company called, I think, Hicks Muse in Houston, a radio company. And they got the FCC to lighten up on how much ownership you could have of radio stations in a market. And correct me if I'm wrong here, guys, but it seems to me that up until that time, you could own 20 radio stations in a market, but if they had a market share of over 25%, you had to divest some of them.
Right.
And, but they got them to ease up on those regulations, and they started buying up radio stations left and right. So you had SFX Broadcasting, and Sillerman wanted to do a radio show, as they call it, in New York City. And he got with the local promoter there, Ron Delsner, who was, you know, one of the original concert promoters. He's a character and a half. I met him a couple of times. And as they were talking, Delsner explained to Sillerman, you've got all these concert promoters that own property. We owned property at Sunshine. We had Deer Creek, we had Polaris in my hometown, Columbus, Ohio. We had the Murat Theater here, mm-hmm. We had the Louisville Palace.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Maybe we didn't have the Palace at that moment. But having said that, which was a theater, mm-hmm. Sillerman came up with this idea of, well, I'm buying radio stations with the intent to sell them. Why can't I buy concert promoters that own property or own booking rights? Because he could not believe that you had all these promoters that really, they knew each other. They communicated a little bit. They had the North America Concert Promoters Association, but they still weren't sharing inside secrets. But he also thought, wait a minute, you have these amphitheaters, Polaris in Columbus, Ohio, Riverport in St. Louis, Deer Creek in Indianapolis, as an example, Walnut Creek in Charlotte. Why aren't those called the Coors Light Amphitheater? Why isn't that the Coca-Cola Amphitheater? Why isn't that? And he saw this big picture. Mm-hmm. Sillerman started buying concert promoters. First one was Delsner Slater in New York. The second was Sunshine. I think at the end of the day, it's safe to say Sunshine, probably the owners, Dave Lucas and Steve Sebesma, probably wish they would not have been the second company sold, but maybe the fifth or sixth. They would have probably doubled their money.
Right.
Because the value of it went up. But here was Silliman out by acquiring, you know, Sunshine. He got Pace, which was out of Houston. He got Cellar Door. Don Law out of Boston, Bill Graham Presents. This is after Bill Graham died, mm-hmm. as an example. Evening Star, Danny Zalesko in the Phoenix area. Several others, Alex Cooley in Atlanta, even to a lesser extent, Feline in Denver. So Silliman had all these promoters under the moniker SFX Entertainment. And he had already sold the radio stations to Hicks Views. And then he sold the concert division to Hicks Views, and they spun it off as Clear Channel.
I was just going to ask if this is when Clear Channel came about.
The bird. And
that, from that point, I stopped being Steve Girardi, and I became employee numbered boom, 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 96, my social security number.
There you go.
I made a mistake one time in an interview of saying that to a newspaper, and they put my social security number in the freaking newspaper.
But some dude in Russia is like going, well, we got this guy. So
then it was Clear Channel Entertainment.
Right.
And then in 2004, they spun that, the entertainment division off into what's called Live Nation.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure what happened. Okay. I think there still is Clear Channel. They had radio stations, outdoor advertising, billboards, and the concert division. But it was a, suddenly it was a corporate thing, and it still is. And they have great people at Live Nation. Don't get me wrong. Silliman realized back in the 90s into the early 2000s, I need Don Law in Boston to do this. I need Dave Lucas in Indianapolis to do this. I need this person here. I need that person there. And now it's changed so much. And I left in 2004. I was actually let go, and that was fine with me. And I had shifted away from doing really from doing smaller bookings and production into special events. And I was also booking some clubs, and it was just, the timing was right. And I just decided, you know, I can do this on my own. And quite frankly, when that spinoff happened, I was not in the cards. And that was fine with me. I did not want to be part of that, quite frankly.
Right.
And so I went on my own, and in October will be 20 years.
So I'm really curious, because I didn't realize that that's how that was. I didn't know like Deer Creek was owned by an actual like production company. You know, that I figured, because, you know, okay, say Evansville. You know, Evansville, Robert Stadium, which is now defunct, but now it's the Ford Center, or the new Ford Center, and then Mesker at the time, and I know like the center, they call it, in Victory, that's all owned by the city, but they have, it's Ogden, I think. It used to be Ogden. I don't know if it's for sure now, but they have a company.
Venue management company.
Right.
And many, you're going to find in many cities, many of the venues, especially at times theaters or arenas, are owned by the city or the county, right, or some sort of government entity. That's gotcha. Very, very common, or there's some sort of tie-in with it. Rarely, I think, would you see that. Yet the amphitheater boon of the 80s and 90s was really, you had Niederlander with their summer symphony amphitheaters. Now let's go off and talk about that for a second. They had Blossom Music Center up in Cleveland, which is still there. They had Riverbend in Cincinnati. They had Pine Knob in Detroit. They had Poplar Creek in Chicago. And I know I'm missing one or two, but these were more the summer symphony venues. But then you suddenly had the promoters buying property, building their own venue and managing it and retaining all the revenue. That's the key right there.
Well, and that's why Deer Creek is built out in Noblesville. Oh. Noblesville was no place. And then actually the town around it, all that stuff that's there now, the stores and restaurants, is there because of Deer Creek.
And Deer Creek is actually the third and a half location.
Third and a half?
Thank you. I'm glad.
What is that? What does that mean?
What?
So tell us, Steve.
The first, starting in 87, the first location was going to be in Westfield near the intersection of 31 and 32. We thought that was going to happen, and it got shot down. The second location was going to be at the White River State Park. Thank God they did not build that amphitheater there, because it would have been a disaster. They would have had to have rebuilt the whole thing. And the design had the back of it butting right up. This is where the lawn is right now, the Everwise Amphitheater. But the design was different, and it would have butted right up to the river, which meant you could not get vehicles back there.
Oh, geez.
And when you're building a venue, you've got to really, you just can't factor in that you've got 12, 14,000 capacity. You got to think about a stage. You got to think about, how do we get stuff to and from that stage?
You got semi trucks that are going to come in. Yeah.
Exactly. And that fell through. And then for about 15 minutes, they looked at a site almost in Boone or Hendricks County on West 86th Street that just fell through. But here was Hamilton County really wanting to have, they were very liberal with their development, and they were just open to things happening. And even though the initial place, I want to say, it was in Hamilton County, things were different a year later. And here we came upon this farm of about 280 acres where the guy had inherited from his father, and just early 50s, wanted to sell it and retire, and knew he was sitting on something good. And I was not involved with those negotiations, but I guess at the very last minute, he wanted an extra $1 million.
Oh,
good for him. What were they going to say? No, he was going to sell it, but good for him for that. But that's where that came to be. And so on August the 13th, 1988, right after he had harvested his crops, we started construction of then Deer Creek Music Center. And we opened on, I want to say it was May 22nd, 1989. I booked the very first concert there with Sandy Patty. We really wanted an Indiana artist to open the venue. And at that time, we had a great relationship with John Mellencamp, and his father and I are still, I have not texted with his father since this afternoon. Richard is my father. When I need a father, he's my go-to.
Wow.
And I was just with him about a month ago. But that said, John didn't want to play amphitheaters, but the year before, we had also just played a show with him at the fairgrounds and drew 45,000 people. And so John was out. You think about that van, you think about David Lee Roth at that time with that Indiana connection. No, Guns N' Roses hadn't really hit with that Indiana connection. Right. Michael Jackson just wasn't there. And suddenly it was like, well, what about Sandy Patty? And I started doing some hard selling on this. Like, you know, this is a perfect show to start with. It's almost like, it's like stretching before you run. and I had done a lot of shows with Sandy. I had a great relationship with her, but it was really the ideal show because there were so many unknown factors with the venue.
Right.
So the complexity wasn't as much there as it would have been with one of the bigger touring acts that was out at the time. Yeah.
The following year we opened with two nights of Guns N' Roses.
Yeah.
Those were the second worst nights of my life. No, just kidding. But having said that, Sandy was the perfect first show at Deer Creek. And it was a basic production. We sold about 6,500 tickets. People came there. It's a peaceful crowd. That's not a beer drinking bunch.
No.
I know that shocked you guys to hear that. but it was
religious.
But it still was a great way to get started. Right. The next night we had Cinderella, and that was, you know, we learned a lot about the venue that day. That was when we had a couple of ordinances there. That I'm going to tell a great little story here, but we had to agree that all concerts from Sundays through Thursdays had to end at 10:30, mm-hmm. and Saturdays end by 11. But we also had a decibel level of, I want to say it was 115 decibels. 115 decibels a half mile from the property line, which would be almost impossible to hit.
Right.
If you had a jet airplane firing, it wouldn't. But at that show, with the Cinderella show, my buddy Lori Quigley was running the sound, and they had this Tasco sound system that many of the British bands used, many rock bands used, because it was a loud, ugly sound system. Just, there's no other way to describe a Tasco band. And Lori Quigley, Australian guy, fired the PA up to right at about 122 to 124 decibels inside the pavilion, which is just ear-shattering. Yet at the property line, it barely hit 75 decibels. I knew right then we will never get hit for this.
Yeah, line. That's never going to be a problem.
Wow.
Then I've been to some loud shows up there too, and it's
then we booked Guns N' Roses the next year.
Yeah,
but that's another story. But you know, having said that, I look at that first year of Deer Creek, and I think we had four really key shows that year. We had our first show with Sandy Patty. We had Frank Sinatra on July 1st. Now we had reached. Wow. We booked other artists like Bob Hope, who I just. Got a picture of him up here. I loved working with him. He's from Cleveland. He liked me. But Frank Sinatra, Grateful Dead, July 15th. That was the quintessential show at Deer Creek. The other fourth important show was Elton John in late August of that year. But let me backtrack a little bit. So we were booking a lot of shows. We were booking things that we normally would not have booked, but the ownership, Dave Lucas, Steve Sebesma, were smart enough to realize we had to bring in a variety. When we were trying to build Deer Creek, we had a citizens group going against us called RAD, Residents Against Detrimental Development. And these people were just, they were screwy. They were nuts.
They're buttholes.
they liked seeing their names in the paper. And at one point, they made an accusation at some city hearing that we would book 80 concerts a year with 18,000 people with the likes of Ozzy Osbourne and Motley Crue. And Dave Lucas said, who are the other 78 bands that can sell 18,000 tickets? I want to know who they are because we want to book those bands. But
send us a list.
But it really just was kind of cute. You know what? Know what you're talking about when you're going to make accusations like that. But
sure.
You go back to that. We booked a variety of different things, many things that didn't sell a lot of tickets, but they looked good. We had sponsors. Finally, we were selling box seats. So the Grateful Dead, I had that bad experience in 84, but we had a Grateful Dead show in Louisville on... I want to say April the 10th of 84, Sunday night at Freedom Hall. And at that time, we were slowly talking with them about trying to play at Deer Creek. And right after that, they sent a couple of their reps out to look at us under construction. And that booking happened. It was a last minute booking with the Dead. But that was also our very first sellout. That was the night when we knew that we were really good. You know, another key element about Deer Creek was we did not know how to manage a venue. But we had a great venue in town, Market Square Arena, and they knew how to manage a venue. So Sunshine Promotions, I was, again, not involved with this, made a deal with Market Square Arena. to be the management company for Deer Creek for a fee and a percentage. Right. And it kind of gave them something in the summertime because they didn't have a lot going on. But they knew all these little nuances. Just like it's one thing to book a show, one thing to produce it. But how do you hire staff? How do you manage your staff? How do you manage parking? How do you manage concessions? How do you make deals with ticketing companies, which was Ticketmaster or sponsor? They brought all that to the table. And we looked at each other that night after that Grateful Dead show, and just we all knew that we were really good. Another key show was another late booking with Elton John. Now, and that was a Wednesday night, I believe, in August, late August. At that time, Elton John's manager, his booking agent, it's a guy named Howard Rose. Now, Howard Rose was the ultimate power rock agent ever in Hollywood. You know, Beverly Hills, Rolls Royce, suit and tie, you know, Jack, you know, but his clientele, he had Chicago, Dan Fogelberg, Stevie Nicks, a guy named Jimmy Buffett, and Elton John.
Never heard of him.
And years earlier, Howard had booked the band Queen.
Oh, I think I've heard of them.
Yeah.
Now, Queen was not a big band in Indiana. Hmm. And one of the biggest money losses that Sunshine Promotions ever had was doing a Queen show at Market Square Arena in the early 80s, I believe, to the point where they could not finish paying the band. And that caused a rift with us and Howard Rose before my time. I didn't know this story till a few years ago. But Howard Rose came out, liked what he saw, and he said, "You're getting Jimmy Buffett next year." And so that's why I say those were the four key shows. Sandy Patty to start. Frank Sinatra added credibility. Grateful Dead showed how good we are. Jimmy Buffett showed what we can do.
Wow.
And that was our first year at Deer Creek.
So that was sorry.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Dennis.
No, real quick. I've been to Deer Creek, Deer Creek is, you know, whatever it is now, quite a few times in the last few years. Now, I know that the concession areas and stuff, they've always, you know, fixing that up and doing better. Is the stage in the berm area the same as it was when you first built the place? Like it was?
In my book, after experience, and again, you don't know this stuff. The biggest mistake at Deer Creek is the load-in area, because there is a structural beam that is 9 feet 2 inches.
Oh, that hasn't been fixed.
Well, you want to build a venue. The inside of a semi truck is 9 feet 6 inches.
Right.
I know that sounds crazy. That 4 inches can be a killer. The second thing is the load in area is tight. But at that time, you didn't have when you brought in a concert at that time, a show, if it traveled in 4, 5, 6 semi trucks, that was a big show.
Right.
Now you fast forward.
Taylor Swift comes in with her.
Now
Envoy.
Now you fast forward to many of these shows being in 8, 10, 12 semi trucks, sure, playing in theaters. And I kind of wish we would have had a bigger stage. I wish the pitch on the pavilion was just a slight bit higher. But other than that, it was a it's pretty much a perfect venue. It really is. They've learned how to adopt, and they've made changes. They're, you know, Live Nation is very good at marketing. They are very, very good at selling concessions. And I don't mean that in a negative way. If the three of us owned a venue, we'd want to do it that same way too.
Mm-hmm.
And they are really good at boom, you have to sell things fast. You just can't take time with it. It's got to be go, go, go. And you can charge the hell out of it. And, you know, it's up to you if you want to buy a ticket. It's up to you if you want to buy it, if you want to buy a beer or whatever. And that's your own choice. Nobody's putting a gun to your head saying you have to buy something. But they know how to do that. And they're very, very good at it. When the whole conglomeration of promoters came together, you may or may not follow me on this, but try to. In the industry, you have your entertainers. Entertainers have managers. Entertainers have booking agents. There's a difference between a manager and a booking agent. Manager's job is to manage the entertainer, manage it through bookings, through the record deal, whatever else. The booking agent's sole job at that time was to sell the band, okay? Or sell the entertainer. Now booking agencies have expanded with many other things, branding, sponsorship, social media. I mean, it's amazing how many services they offer. Many times it's not just, well, we're a rock band playing for William Morris. William Morris may be looking at us for a TV show or something like that. There's so many opportunities. But when all of this came together, the fear in the industry was by the booking agencies was SFX / then Clear Channel were going to bypass the booking agencies and make deals directly with the managers. Any manager that has an ounce of brains in their 10-ton head would never agree to that. Because why do that to yourself for 20 dates when you need that booking agent to sell those other 100 dates of the year? But that was a concern. And the smarter managers got together, Irving Azoff, Howard Kaufman, who managed Jimmy Buffett, as an example, several others, and just decided, you know what? We can go for the kill with these guys. They need us more than we need them. They need programming at their amphitheaters. And they did just that. And quite frankly, I don't blame them. I would have done the very same thing. So at the end of the day, it's about money. And it's about how much money can you bring in? And we're seeing so many things happen. Right now, I think live entertainment is oversaturated.
There's a lot of venues out there and a lot of venues that are not very full, and you know, but there's a good to that and bad to that, I guess, you know, if you, I like going to shows. I go to shows all the time. I go to name shows. I mean, I'm not going to just to see, you know, Bob's House of Blues or whatever, hanging out I don't typically do that unless I know somebody in the band. But in the indie market itself, I mean, you get the hi-fi annex, you talked about the Vogue. There's, you know, the Egyptian, there's, I don't know what, four venues now at Mirai, which, by the way, that the whatever's in the basement. I can't think of the, what's it called in the basement?
You talked me out of a concert the other day, yeah, because you said it's,
yeah, the Deluxe Room is like the worst place in the world to go to a show.
What's their response to the Vogue?
Yeah, but it's not a very good,
but they can do all ages here.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I get that. So, you know, I like going to a lot of different shows, and you get to go into a lot of different places. I think that's the cool part. You know, it's just sometimes there's so much to try to figure out and filter through.
Exactly.
To pick.
And you're seeing the heritage acts.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Suddenly playing in tertiary markets and selling tickets in smaller theaters that they were doing that 5, 10, 15 years ago. You know, one of the things that I think saved a lot of rock bands and a lot of classic rock bands was the advent of the riverboat casinos. Follow me on this.
Yeah, that makes sense. They had a place to go.
So in the mid to late 90s, from like 94 to 2010, suddenly the Eddie Money's and the 38 Specials and the Lover Boys and the REO Speedwagons and the Cheap Tricks could not sell tickets.
Foreigner.
Foreigner could not sell tickets. Journey could not sell tickets. Def Leppard could not sell tickets. And the list keeps going. So suddenly they had to drop out of the Coliseum level, maybe play a theater, maybe play a large club. I booked a 1800 capacity nightclub in Fort Wayne for 18 years called Pierre, 17 years.
Yeah. I've
And
never been there, but I want to go there.
I put REO in there. I put the Doobies in there. I put oh God, who else? Huey Lewis in there as an example. But here came these casinos that suddenly were paying top dollar. Now,
Right.
did the acts like it? No, they didn't like the lack of production. They didn't like that they weren't on a big stage, but they liked the money. And
They like the
that kept
money.
money flowing. And then it just feels like after about 2010, 2012, suddenly that all came back. And I think Live Nation did a great job packaging those tours, putting REO and Styx together, putting Steve Miller out
Yeah.
with somebody, putting Foreigner out with somebody, then Huey Lewis out with somebody. Here comes Journey, with a huge end around, probably helped by the Sopranos. Here comes Def Leppard out, really charging back. And I think that suddenly people love the hits. A DJ said something to me interesting a few years ago, that people want to hear the hits live just like they do the record.
Right.
Yep.
I personally, myself, I like it live. I want to hear you play, have fun with it.
Right.
But that said, people really want to hear it. When I book a lot of these bands, perhaps for a corporate event or a special event, I'm very clear that I want them to play the hits. I do not want to hear new music.
That's a death knell.
One of the worst things that you can hear at a concert is, we have a new album coming out.
Yep.
I'm going to the bathroom. I'm gonna get a beer.
And
I'm leaving. I'm doing something.
in the late 80s, I'm going to go philosophical here. I hope we have some time here.
Sure.
You saw the push from the record labels who controlled it at that time was they wanted a crossover top 40 song.
For
So
sure.
you saw Journey put out an album with a ba Lead with a Ballad, disaster. Foreigner, new album, Lead with a Ballad, disaster. The Cars, new album, Lead with a Ballad, disaster. REO, new album, Lead with a Ballad, disaster. And suddenly, the people wanted to hear the things that they liked. They did not want to hear that new music. In 1988, two significant concert tours were announced that I got to work both. Rolling Stones, Steel Wheels, Paul McCartney. And I'm thrilled that I got to work with both and meet both. Both of them put out new albums that were disasters. Nobody can remember one song from the Steel Wheels album. Nobody can name one song from the album Flowers in the Dirt. And we saw that happening more and more of that. And just I respect the fact that entertainers are artists, they're always wanting to create. But chances are good you would rather have seen a Picasso painting when he was in his 70s or however old he was, then hear a new song by a classic rock band. I don't care who the band is. Look at the Rolling Stones Hackney Diamonds album. I mean, what's that song? Is it Angry?
Oh, I don't know.
I can't even tell you, dude.
They played it. They played the hell out of it. But
I don't even know.
They start their tour this week in Houston.
Oh.
And nobody cares.
Nobody gives a shit.
Right. And
I want to hear Paint It Black. I want to hear all the, you want to hear the classics. Exactly. You want to hear the classics.
And, look at Bruce Springsteen. What did Springsteen do? He went back to playing his hits like the albums.
He got smart.
He was trying to play things and go off center and try to redo it. Nobody cared when he was playing stuff. Nobody cared. Now he's back to the hits and doing huge.
Well, it becomes a little self-indulgent, right? I mean, I think that the artists themselves feel like they need to do that because they need to continue to grow or exactly. share or whatever. And I get that. But the reality of it is I paid the 80 bucks or the 70 bucks or God knows what it is now. Yeah. I want to hear the stuff that I saw years ago. I want to hear I don't want to hear the stuff that is, and a great example of that is,
say Peter Frampton. Come on, say Peter Frampton.
I was going to say something else, but that's okay. Is Peter Frampton not doing? Is he not doing old stuff now? Is he doing his only new stuff?
Go ahead, though. Yeah. I was being silly.
Well, I mean, you know, so when Kiss and Aerosmith did the tour, the co-headlining tour, that was at Deer Creek, or whatever it was that year. Klipsch, I don't know. Very excited to go. I think it was a mistake that Aerosmith let Kiss open because. Sitting in the lawn, sitting
I'll explain
where I
that when you're done. Let me explain that when you're done.
Okay. So watching what happened was what I saw happen was Kiss played and half the crowd left and Aerosmith walked out and started playing songs from this Honkin' on Bobo record that nobody got and nobody people just kept leaving. And finally I'm like, this is ridiculous. I have not heard one song. It was probably, I think it was like six or seven songs in before I found an Aerosmith song that I even recognized. And I had their catalog. It was horrible.
It was horrible.
So at that time, Aerosmith was managed by Howard Kaufman. Let's go back to all the promoters getting together. Who was one of the ones that said, let's cash in? Howard Kaufman. Aerosmith played Indianapolis six times over a four-year period at that time. No, Jesus wasn't on the bill. But when you have a co-bill like that, typically it is one plays first, one plays second. The next night, the guy that played closed plays first. And I think it would be hard to follow either band on that. Yeah, having said that, you go back to... In 92, was it Guns and Metallica toured stage?
Yeah.
After Axl Rose, the Metallica guys went to the Guns N' Roses guys and just said, you know what, from now on, we're going to play second every night. You guys close every night. And Guns N' Roses was stupid enough to go for that. I want to emphasize they were stupid. Stupid enough to go over that.
Yeah.
So what had happened was they were playing at in stadiums. The band Faith No More was opening. Mm-hmm. But you have a stadium show where the people are there most of the day. They're drinking and partying. The doors open 4 o'clock-ish, 5 o'clock-ish. Faith No More would probably play from 6 to 7. The next band, 7:30 to 9, 9:15. The next closing act, 9:30 to 11, whatever, just maybe 90 minutes set.
Yeah.
But two things happen. First of all, the crowd is tired.
Yep.
They're buzzed.
Yep.
They don't have the energy to rock with it. If I were in a band and I had to play on one of those bills, I would want to play in the middle section. I would not want to close the show. I would rather play in the middle where you've got the active crowd and you got the most crowd attention.
Yeah, that's good. I never thought of that.
If you're going to close the show, you better come out with your best stuff. You just can't come out and open it dull. We'll see. It's interesting. Train, REO, Speedwagon are going out this year. Mm-hmm. Great games.
Yep.
And I love the REO guys. That's extended family to me. but they're still taking an opening act, the Yacht Rock Revue, out with them.
It was great. Really good.
I could go into my garage and get a garden trowel and scratch my head on this one, trying to figure out why in the fuck did Art, God, I cussed.
That's okay. No, you're fine. We are uncensored.
Doing this because neither of those bands wants to go on first.
and Yacht Rock in Indiana, especially because a lead singer from there is from Columbus.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Okay. Nespajani is from Columbus.
I did not know that.
Yeah. So around here, they are very huge. they sold the Brown County Music Center over here out in like 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Which is a 2,000 seat place for the Rock Yacht Review. It's a
great place.
Yeah. I want to see those guys.
I want to see those guys.
And I get that they want to get out and expose themselves. I really do. I think they could do better on their own, but that's, what do I know? I'm not their agent. And I think the world of Hank Saxer, their booking agent, I think the world of him, but just still. But still at the end of the day, these acts don't want to, they don't want to play first. Yet years ago, you would see, you always saw Chicago, the Moody Blues and the Beach Boys. And for what it's worth, of like a Crosby and maybe a CSN, always seemed to tour together. Yet it was one than the other. It wasn't, we need a third act to open. And I always thought those were good shows, but you know, that was back in the day.
Right.
Steve, it's getting to be an hour. I just want to be cognizant of your time. Are you good for a little bit longer? All right.
We usually stop
at an hour, but I want to keep having a conversation if Dennis is good for it and you're up for it. Cause I've got
to make that before Bill gets to his question.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, go. I have interrupted you guys. You had some questions.
I just want to say, I'm going to make one statement before we get going, and I'm going to let Bill ask, because he actually studied and did some research. You made the comment about Roberts Stadium. Mm-hmm. I went to the Gene Simmons vault thing and got the Gene Simmons vault, and I'm talking to Gene and knowing that, you know, Evansville was a big, I mean, Sunshine had them in, I don't know how many, I mean, they at one point were neck and neck with Madison Square Garden as far as many times they played Robert Stadium. Anyway, I'm talking to Gene. I said, I'm from Evansville, and I'm sure you know about Robert Stadium. He looked at me and goes, you know, that's not a stadium.
So
yeah, had to correct me.
We did a run of shows like in 92 or 93. This is Kiss Unmasked. Christmas week, starting the December 26th right up to January 2, with the exception of New Year's Eve and New Year's Day.
Okay.
And we did it a couple times with Cheap Trick 1 year, Rat 1 year. We did it with Kiss 1 year, and the opening act was Autograph.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Was that show?
Saw that show.
Saw it too.
And what was funny was, if you ever heard that Autograph album with that song, Turn Up the Radio, mm-hmm. I mean, it is below sucking. It is one of the worst albums ever made. It makes Spinal Tap. It makes Spinal Tap sound like Steely Dan.
Nice.
The singer from the band would get mad at the crowd for not responding and yell at the crowd a few times, which cracked me up. But we did like Johnson City, Tennessee, Knoxville, Memphis, Evansville. It seems like we did a Fort Wayne date. And I'll never forget staying at the then, I think it was the Radisson Inn at the airport.
Yeah. Yep.
And the day before the show or the day after the show, getting on the elevator, and there's Gene Simmons. And a quick introduction. You know, and we had met a couple times. Oh, yeah, I like Sunshine. Da, da, da. Gene suddenly recalls the settlement from one of the previous shows. From that day, I always respected him. I thought, oh, I really like this guy now. He knows, you know, Gene Simmons and Billy Gibbons from ZZ Top were on top of their numbers all the time.
Oh, yeah, Gene.
That just impressed the hell out of me. But, yeah. So, and seeing Roberts went through, you had the old Roberts Stadium, then you had the renovated Roberts Stadium.
Yeah.
Yep.
When they renovated it, it had
they
that.
Fucked it. They fucked it up.
Well, in the back, though, But that was a perfect area for Metallica to do rehearsals for their tour, their first headline tour with the Diamond Stage.
Right.
It's all fabricated and done in Evansville. You know who else came in a year later and did that? Garth Brooks.
Garth Brooks did.
Yeah, I remember that.
He rented it for like a week.
Roberts Stadium, it was the perfect place if you were carrying a stage. I want to emphasize carrying a stage because you had so much room back there to make adjustments. They could go bring in welders and do this and refabricate and change things. Wow. Because they had that massive area. And I remember when they were renovating it, the architects brought me in. They had an architect company. I forget the big one out of Kansas City. But they brought me to Evansville, flew me to Evansville to talk to them. And then they came to our offices. They wanted, it was very flattering to talk to these guys. You know, I mean, they're educated. I'm not, but just.
The one big mistake they made on that renovation was they lowered the floor. And they lowered it below the water table.
Oh, boy.
And they had pumps that ran 24/7 to constantly pump water off that floor.
So I'm going to tell you a great Evansville story. I'm going to tell you a great Robert Stadium story. I think I can say this now.
Sure.
35, in the old days, old
it's days. Gone.
So you had several commissioners, John Hill, the manager, Larry Aiken. They started charging for parking, like $2 or $3 a car.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
I loved going into the meeting room at Robert Stadium with all that cash on the table and watching those guys divide it up. It was like watching the movie Casino, where all the greasers were getting their money, but everybody was just getting their share of that $500,000 or whatever. In ones and fives and tens. Oh, it was a hoot and a half. And the funny thing was, I probably could have sat at the table, picked up a couple $100s, and nobody would have said a thing, but I didn't. But I love that about Robert Stadium.
Well, the interesting thing is my girlfriend at the time, which is my wife, that we went to high school together, she lived right across the street from the stadium. Mm-hmm. So we never paid a dime because we parked at her house and walked over.
You bastard. You need to go to Larry Aiken's grave.
Larry needs to call you up right now and say, Bill, we need to leave
a quarter on his tombstone right now.
Well, I tell you what, Steve, maybe you and I can meet for lunch someday and continue having a conversation, and I'll give you $10.
Okay. Well, all right, guys.
All right. I had a couple questions for you.
Sure.
What artist that you worked with was the one that you just today, you still can't believe had that opportunity?
I'm going to have to say a few. Okay.
Okay. Yeah.
I have to say the Rolling Stones. I'm going to have to say Paul McCartney. I'm going to have to say Grateful Dead. I'm going to have to say doing Page Plant shows.
Mm. Nice.
You know, so that's probably what I would say to that.
Is there anybody that you would never work with again?
Oh God, yes.
if you don't feel comfortable mentioning anybody, I understand.
Let's ever book Cool and the Gang again. There are some acts that you just can't stand, and it just really and it's not that you don't like their music, you don't like them.
And yeah, I can see that.
So the ones that are in it for the long game are in it for the long game. It's the ones that are in it for the short game. Just I could care less if I ever worked with the band Tears for Fears again. I could care less if I ever saw the band Oasis or heard their music again. Just they were just idiots. There's no other way to describe it.
Hmm. Wow. Hmm. Yeah, I'm not a big fan of either one of them either.
You know, conversely, I could.
I own no T-shirts of Tears.
I could work with REO and Styx every day and be thrilled. I could work with Huey Lewis every day and be thrilled. There were many classy acts out there. Reba McEntire. Reba Flush is more class down the toilet every day than most rock acts will ever have.
Wow.
Bruce Springsteen, first class. Billy Joel, first class. Elton John, first class. Front to back. Starting with their truck drivers to the people that work for them. Just, wow. I can't say enough great things about them. I wish I could still, I wish I was in that area, in that arena with them. I'll tell you an act that I'm going to tell you a great Evansville story with this band. Okay.
Okay.
Have you ever heard of a band called AC/DC?
No,
once
never
or twice.
No.
So I loved working AC/DC shows because I liked the guys. There were two bands that for the most part would spend typically when a band plays a show, they, after the show, they get on their buses or their planes and they fly to the next city. But two bands always stayed behind. AC/DC was one, Motley Crue was the other. So here we were as Sunshine Promotions, not only just doing shows in Indianapolis, but Fort Wayne, South Bend. Yeah, South Bend's a bad example. Evansville, Louisville, Lexington, Knoxville, Johnson City, Dayton, Cincinnati, Columbus. And many times I got, you know, after when Loadout was close to done, I'd go back to the hotel and here's the bands in the bar when bars stayed open till 2. So I hung out with those guys a lot. So I'm doing an AC/DC show in Evansville, Roberts Stadium. This would have been probably 90, 91. And at that time, Larry Aiken's restaurant, Greenlee's, did I say that right? Was doing
the Greenlee's. I remember that. Yeah, I remember that.
Which that's, just, I didn't like. So don't leave that quarter on his grave.
Thank you. And
his save me a quarter.
His restaurant manager screwed something up. The band, the guys in AC/DC had a thing where when they were done playing in their dressing room, they wanted a large bowl of fresh mashed potatoes and a large bowl of fresh beef gravy.
That's the craziest thing I've heard.
That's a writer. I thought M&Ms were weird.
I thought brown M&Ms.
Brown M&Ms were weird, but no.
Mashed potatoes are great. It's
impossible to screw something like this up.
Right.
But this restaurant screwed this up. And they... No, it wasn't. Let me back up. Let me back up. It wasn't Greeley's. It was, they had this in-house concessionaire, a guy named Jack Daniels, who was a complete fucking idiot. And I did my second cuss word. And I actually got him fired from that. Robert.
I used to know a guy named Jack. He's dead now, but I knew a guy named Jack Daniels.
But this guy had the t-shirt concessions and the food and beverage. And he served instant mashed potatoes and instant gravy.
Wow. To AC/DC.
And I blew my stack and I called Greeley's and they bailed me out that night.
Oh, there you go.
Wow.
But this guy was actually, and I don't care if he's still alive or not, but I,
the one I knew is dead. So
I went against this guy when I did the Metallica rehearsals and first show down there and just would not pay him what he was wanting paid. But then I turned around and showed proof that he was underreporting the t-shirt revenue and he got fired and they fired his company from that.
There you go.
There was something wasn't, their numbers were way low compared to the tour numbers and the tour sent me the info and it's one of the times I ever just really thought.
That's what you get for fucking up mashed potatoes and gravy for AC/DC.
Well, it wasn't that, but ever after that, though, I would personally taste their mashed potatoes and gravy. And that was, it had to be in there. If that show was going down at 10:30, it had to be in there at 10:15. And I was in there with my own spoon. I wanted to taste it to make sure it was good for those guys. And they remembered that. So
that is a great story. Oh, you didn't know that.
That's got to be the ending. There's not going to be. I don't know where we can go from there. That is
there
perfect.
That'd be, well, picked Steve, up tomorrow.
It has been an honor, man, to be able to hang out with you for a little bit tonight. And hearing the stories. And I'm gonna be honest with you, I was so jazzed.
Why? I don't care.
It was just it was. I've been wanting to get somebody like you on the show for a long time, and I reached out to several people, and then nobody will ever respond. Right. I'm like, dude, I'm just going to, I saw that on TV, and I'm like, I'm just going to reach out and see what happens. You responded in within just a matter of minutes and said, you'd be glad to be on the show. Sure. And then for me to have to turn around yesterday and say, I can't do it last night because
you told me on work. Sunday that you said that to me on Sunday. So that was fine.
But it was just, I've had a great time, and really, so I would like to come up and have lunch with you or dinner sometime and continue talking, because I'm spending the summer at Ruoff for the most part.
You have fun.
I'm a Lawnie. I'm what they call it. Now they call me a Lawnie. So I have a lawn pass. My son and I and some friends we got one last year, and we have one this year. So
I think there's quite cool a few shows to go. With your son. You know, in the early 90s, we did a lot of shows with the band Rush, and my next book is Geddy Lee's book, My Effin' Life.
I haven't read that yet. I have
just got it. It's sitting on my table, but
I have this one. I have Neil's.
Oh, nice.
Ghost Rider. That is actually, if you want to read a really good book, that's too about after when his wife had cancer, and then his daughter died first in a car accident, and then his wife had cancer, and he gets on his motorcycle and he just travels the world for a couple years. And this is all about that. It's a really good book.
Forward in Kenny Aronoff's book, Sex, Drums, and Rock and Roll.
Neil Peart
forward in that.
Right.
Neil Peart, but we were doing a Rush show at Deer Creek in the early 90s, and Howard Ungerleiter, their longtime lighting designer and road manager, and I love Howard. He's with a band called Tool right now.
Oh, yeah.
And Howard made a comment to me. He said, look and see if you see a lot of fathers and sons coming to shows. And sure enough, you started looking around and like, that's got to be a father and son. You know, this looks like some, 38-year-old guy with his 15-year-old son. And you looked around and you saw more of it. And then the next thing you know, you look back and you see that father and son, and they're wearing matching Rush t-shirts. I'm thinking, I hope those guys drank a beer on the way. And if they smoked a joint, so what? But I thought that was so cool. But one of the things interesting about Neil Peart was Geddy and Alex usually chartered between cities on a plane.
Right.
And sometimes Alex or sometimes Neil would fly with them, but one of the one of the buses that they had a trailer.
Yeah, he had his motorcycle with him all the time.
And if it was suddenly, you know what, we're in St. Louis tonight, we're going to be in Indianapolis tomorrow night, the weather looks good, pull my bike off, I'm going to get a hotel room, and he would ride into the next city by himself. And I always thought that was so. Steve Howe from the band Yes did that same thing, except in
a station. That is cool.
The driver. Sometimes they just want to be, but yeah, their Rush was just beyond first class. Their quirky thing in the dressing room, guys.
What's that?
And we'll end it probably on this.
Okay.
They wanted the small 7-ounce Coca-Cola in bottles.
No mashed potatoes.
Why not? Well, I'll tell you, Steve, the first time my son went to see Kiss, which is very interesting because I'm a huge Kiss fan, as you can see behind me. The first time he was 12 years old. I tricked him. I took him to Chicago to the United Center. Mm-hmm. Quick story. We ended up getting backstage to meet Gene Simmons because of the people who were sitting behind us. And I started talking to them, and they worked for A&E at the time. And that was when Gene had the show. So the very first show, big show he ever went to, he met Gene Simmons, and his picture's right over there. And I tried to get it off the wall, but I have it like taped up there. But to your point, my kids, we've been going to shows since they were little, and it's such an important part of our life.
It's really cool.
And it's really cool. That's the thing. I love spending time with them at those things. You know, so
people criticize Kiss and whatever, but they're smart. They realize this is money. They realize it's about marketing and money in the 70s before anybody else realized that.
Yep.
Yep.
And
they sold it for $300 million.
Yeah.
Good for them.
Yeah.
You know, And I hope other bands, quite frankly, I wouldn't blame other bands if they sell their publishing rights. If they own them, that's the key. If they own
it. A lot of them lost it in the early days because they made bad contracts in the start.
Yeah. You know, they sold their publishing rights for next to nothing, thinking it was Led Zeppelin.
Yeah. Right. Yep.
A lot of people.
Peter Grant sold that in the 70s. And, but you know, at the end of the day, it's about money. And, there are so many areas to make money, and just why not? So,
All right, Steve, hang on just a second. Let me take us out of here. All right. You can find us on Ages of Rock Pod, agesofrock.com. We're on Facebook. We're on all the social media stuff.
I'm going to get your friend request too, by the way. I'm not going to.
Oh, okay, cool.
If somebody I don't know sends me a friend request,
I don't blame you.
If they have a guitar in their hands or they're on a stage, if I don't know them, I don't take it.
Yeah, I don't blame
because they might be a creep.
Could be totally sketchy.
Bill is sketchy. So
I'm sketchy.
And the next thing I know, my inbox is filling up with, here's my band. We're the greatest band in the world.
Here's a demo tape.
There you go. All right, we'll see you all next week.
All right, gentlemen. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Ages of Rock podcast. If you haven't done so already, be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel, like us on Facebook, and most importantly, tell all your friends. Remember, you're never too old to rock. Until the next episode, peace out, folks.